WDIY News is pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Jerry for a Lehigh Valley coronavirus update. He is the Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs and Chief Emeritus of Infectious Disease Specialists with St. Luke's University Health Network. Welcome, Doctor. How have you been?
Hi. Oh, I'm pretty well, and I hope you are too.
Thank you for asking, Doctor. I am well and staying healthy. As Pennsylvania begins to reopen, have you seen a spike in new case infections at St. Luke's University Health Network?
This gets into the essence of what a definition of a new case is in terms of a spike. What we have said before, that if you're talking about a positive test for acute disease, this is directly a reflection of how many tests that you're doing. And so the fact that we're much more robust right now in doing widespread testing means that we're going to see increasing numbers of positive tests. That is really not a good objective parameter to compare where we are, for instance, where we were a week or two ago. In that sense, we've made the point that a much more objective parameter would be how many new cases are we seeing that are being hospitalized? Also, are we seeing an increased mortality from the disease that's directly? And in that sense, we have not. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. We have mentioned that at one point in time, we were getting more than 100 to 150 cases that were new COVID admissions to a hospital setting on a daily basis throughout our network. We're now down to well below 30 a day. If we were to take a look at our hospital census, during the peak times about 6 weeks ago, in any given time throughout all of our network hospitals, we had somewhere around 350 COVID-positive patients who were undergoing treatment within the hospital. Now it is less than one-third of that. So I can say with a lot of statistical backing that we are truly bending the curve in the areas that we serve. We're seeing less cases, and the only thing that can create these spikes at this point is the fact that much more testing is being done now than what was being done several weeks ago. In addition, I think it's important to note that we've already spoken about the fact that nursing homes are a particular area where there is a lot of positive activity. It's a closed population that's at high risk. There have been some recent recommendations that all nursing homes that have active cases undergo a situation where all of their residents and all of their staff are tested. And as that is unfolding, we're going to be seeing a great deal more positive tests as well, remembering that many people have no symptoms at all, but you're going to see the tests come back positive. It doesn't mean that you're seeing many, many more cases in the community.
Is it possible to be reinfected with COVID-19, whether you had symptoms or were asymptomatic?
That has been one of the major controversies that is still ongoing, and that is, if you have had this disease and you test positive, can you now eventually get the disease again? Is it a reflection of having testing that may not have been accurate? There seems to be some literature that would support the fact that there are people who seem to have had legitimate testing and also had a very accurate diagnosis of the disease, who then became negative tested and became positive again. How common this is really remains to be seen, but it reflects what is immunity, what happens. And as we have discussed previously, that's an unanswered question. We don't really know whether the immunity that one develops with having COVID-19 is an absolute immunity, in other words, a neutralizing type of antibody that will literally destroy the virus for a period of time, and even if it did, how long it would last. So until those questions are answered, all we can say is that the theoretical possibility of one being able to potentially get this disease again is certainly out there.
Can you tell us more about a recent report of a multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children infected with COVID-19?
I can. Some of these reports are rather disturbing because the one bright spot that we used to refer to is the fact that children seem to be primarily spared from this disease as opposed to older adults. And what we're now seeing is a group of children who seem to be coming down with a syndrome that has all of the criteria of what we would call multi-system, or in other words, involving a number of different areas, whether it's the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, and be seriously ill with a shock-like state in many cases that happens to be related to COVID-19. Having had COVID-19 and then developing this major inflammatory response that leads to this syndrome. What we should be saying is that this is very similar in some ways in the way that it presents to a disease known as Kawasaki's disease. The difference between Kawasaki's disease and this inflammatory disease of children that's related to COVID-19 is the fact that Kawasaki's disease doesn't have this fulminant type of presentation where someone actually can quickly have a drop in blood pressure, go into shock with multi-system failure. That's very uncharacteristic of Kawasaki's disease, but is actually quite characteristic of the other polyinflammatory disease or multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children. That's the actual correct name right now. This has undergone, I might add, several names by the CDC. The current name is the multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children. And we now know there seems to be a connection with this and COVID-19, in that many of these children will test positive for either acute disease or for the antibody that shows that they have a relationship with COVID-19. We actually had one of the first cases in the state, and that occurred back in February. At that time, it wasn't realized what this was. Luckily, the child ended up doing well after having supportive care and is doing fine right now at home. When the syndrome started to be described, we went back and found that there were, in fact, travel history to areas where there was COVID-19 in Europe. And in testing the child and the family, we found that there was evidence that they had had COVID-19 in the past. So that's where a lot of these cases now are starting to be uncovered. People had noticed this, but they really didn't put it together until fairly recently that this was connected with COVID-19. We didn't even realize that we had COVID-19 in Pennsylvania back in February at that time. So the important thing over here is that it's rare, and that if you treat this early, and there are a number of treatments that appear to be effective, most of these children will do quite well. And it is something that we now have to let parents know that they have to look for. And so if you have a child that develops a fever and a rash and starts to become listless in any way or has any difficulty breathing, has abdominal pain, all of those things would be a sign that they need to have a visit with their primary care physician or pediatrician, and the child should be evaluated. And in many cases, one of those evaluations would be a test for COVID-19.
It seems that COVID-19 is an aggravating factor for anyone who has pre-existing conditions and turns the tables far worse.
I think you're correct in that situation. We know that the problem with COVID-19 seems to be the initiation of this, what we call an inflammatory cascade or a cytokine storm. And it's the inflammation that's caused by trying to fight this virus that seems to create the problems in many people, and that's where a lot of the treatment lies. So what we're seeing right now with this Kawasaki-type symptoms that's now multi-system inflammatory syndrome of children is a direct result of this inflammatory cascade that's being initiated in all likelihood by the COVID-19 virus.
There have been reports of stroke possibility in patients age 40 to 50 years old. Can you tell us more about that?
That is among the same situation, really, that we see in adults, whether it's strokes or whether it's an increase in terms of myocardial infarction or heart attacks. All of this has to do with this inflammatory cascade that involves the vessels. When vessels become inflamed, you can get clots that are much more substantial and frequent, and that can lead, if the clots are in vessels that feed the brain, into a stroke, or if they're coronary arteries that feed the heart, it can be a heart attack and so on and so forth. We also see it in some cases. There's been this blue toe syndrome that's been described, and we know that that probably is related to these small clots that are in the vessels that feed the toes.
Recent reports suggest Pennsylvania Secretary of Health Dr. Rachel Levine will be reaching out to the two health systems in the Lehigh Valley to solicit recommendations on how to progress from the red phase to the yellow phase for the reopening of the Lehigh Valley safely. Have you spoken with her yet?
We haven't spoken as of yet, and I do look forward to that conversation. Let me just add that putting political considerations aside, which unfortunately permeates almost everything that happens right now, whether it's with this disease or anything else, I can tell you that making the decision, which is strictly a decision that is related to the governor and obviously his advisors like Rachel Levine, is an extraordinarily tough decision to make. And I certainly can appreciate that. I can appreciate the difficulty. If you open things up too soon, then we may see a surge in cases and people's lives can be at stake. If you open them up too late, then their lives may well be affected in an extremely adverse way from a financial situation and from an emotional situation. If you can't feed your family, that becomes an unbelievable area that you have to consider when you make these decisions. And the other thing that is involved in this is that no matter what decision you make, you know that there are going to be the people who are going to be the Monday morning quarterbacks, and they're going to look at you and say that you either did too much or you did too little. So I think that needs to be out there, that these people have a tremendous responsibility, and I know that they take that responsibility seriously, and we appreciate that that is their decision to make. What we can add to that is a criteria that can be used to help them make the decision, not to make the decision for them, but to help them. And as we've said previously, and what I've also indicated earlier, that looking at just numbers of positive tests that are in a particular area, if you look at that alone, that can be misleading, and that we feel that you need to take into account some other objective evidence, such as the rate of hospitalizations from COVID-19, which we know are dropping, and the mortality statistics, which we also know are dropping, and that one may have to consider not counting closed situations such as a nursing home as part of that, because they don't relate with the rest of the population. The workers do in the nursing homes, but the patients do not. That has been our potential suggestion to them, but they certainly have my sympathy in trying to make these very, very tough decisions, and I know that they're going about it, taking their responsibility very seriously.
Pennsylvania's criteria for moving from one phase to another is 50 cases per 100,000 residents. Have we seen that in Lehigh and Northampton counties?
Well, we haven't hit that level. And in fact, we're quite a bit above that level right now. And that is where we feel that other things need to be considered, because we do have very robust testing. We have increased our testing over here. So we're going to see these cases be much higher than it would be in counties where they're doing very little testing. And the second factor, again, is that we have Bracedale, I've been told, is the largest nursing home in the state. And so you can just imagine that as you test the residents of Bracedale, you're going to find quite a number of positives, and that's going to alter your rate tremendously for Northampton County. That is not a true reflection of what's going on, though, with the general population.
Playing devil's advocate, Doctor, some residents believe that this has all been blown out of proportion. Can you explain why it is not?
People's lives are at stake. This has not been blown out of proportion. As I said, this is an extraordinarily serious matter, and we are not in a situation where we have a tremendous amount of knowledge. What we have is scientific evidence that's been mounting literally daily. So the people that have to make these decisions have to take into account all the evidence that they have for that day and be flexible enough to change as the evidence changes around them. I think I can say with a lot of certainty that as we go through this COVID-19 pandemic, there's probably more that we have found out that we don't know than what we know. And with that in mind, you can understand why there is some sense that conservatism may need to be in place. Once businesses do open up, whether they're in a yellow situation or not, and again, that's the governor's decision, the important thing to note is that social distancing will not disappear as long as COVID-19 is present in our area. And COVID-19, in all likelihood, will be in our area until there is a safe and effective vaccine that's deployed, and that is not the case as of today.
Does the amount of time that you're exposed to COVID-19 factor into your ability to contract it?
The current feeling is that there are two variables involved in you coming down with the disease when you're exposed to an individual, and that would be time and distance. So a passing situation where you're not in close contact with an individual and or it's very transient is much less likely to result in you getting the infection from an infected individual than when you have a much more intense, closer, prolonged contact. So the answer to that is that both of those variables are important in determining whether you're likely to come down with the disease.
What are your impressions of the Moderna vaccine trial's early results?
I'm encouraged. We have said that there are now 8 different companies that I'm aware of that are international and a couple that are in the United States within that 8 that are in trials of their vaccine and where the results right now, at least preliminarily, look very promising. The hope, and certainly we pray that it happens, is that a vaccine that will be safe and effective will be here much sooner than later. And some of the current estimates are it could be within the latter part of this year or in the early part of next year.
Doctor, do you ever find your professional opinion is sometimes at odds with other professionals in your field? And how does that happen?
The essence of science is one of observation and some debate, and eventually you come to a conclusion based on absolute evidence. So there's plenty of room right now for different opinions. And as I said earlier, if you really want to look at this in its true essence, there isn't any one expert on this disease, a disease that has been with us worldwide for less than 6 months, and in the United States for only several months at that. So there's a lot out there to learn. There's a lot that we are learning. We've had a number of different opinions that have changed over time and will change as knowledge is acquired. It's not unusual in any kind of scientific endeavor to have some differences of opinion, and they can be shared with respect, and hopefully, eventually, there's some evidence that will help us reach a consensus conclusion on a lot of the issues that are unanswered right now.
How frustrating is it to be mischaracterized with the factual information you provide to either officials or media outlets to benefit one's perception or story point of view?
Of course, that's an issue, and you sometimes get into what is the 15-second soundbite or the 30-second soundbite that someone will take a piece of what you're saying, and it will be misread or taken out of context. So that's why we hopefully have the ability in many cases to clarify some of the things that have come out where there has not been an accurate portrayal of a true opinion.
Doctor, are you able to share any information about the potential acquisition of Easton Hospital by St. Luke's University Health Network?
What we have said publicly and certainly truly believe is that Easton Hospital has been an extremely valuable resource to the community that it serves for almost 100 years. We believe that it should continue to be maintained as a valuable resource to that community, and we are in conversations with them to try and see how we can help that come to pass so that they can continue to serve their community in the manner that's befitting that community. I can't really tell you the details other than that conversations have been taking place and they continue to take place with the aim that that hospital can remain solvent and serve the community that it has been serving so well for many years.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Jerry of St. Luke's University Health Network. We appreciate your time and expert information.
I hope that was helpful. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope that you, your family, and your colleagues are staying safe and healthy.
For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.